45 seconds.
Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A judge throws out the conviction of Black Panther Geronimo Pratt. What next?
Well, not only are we asking for that he be released on bail, we're asking for an OR, release on own recognizance, while the DA makes a decision. But more than that, I think what needs to happen is that this case be dismissed, that the DA decide that there is no reason to do the right thing and to say, okay, you know, it's been 27 years, it's time just to stop. Just to stop and let this be over for Geronimo.
A look back at historic Supreme Court decisions with original oral arguments of such giants as William Kunstler and Thurgood Marshall.
I worry about the white children in Little Rock who are told as young people that the way to get your rights is to violate the law and defy the lawful authorities. I'm worried about their future. I don't worry about those Negro kids' future. They've been struggling with democracy long enough. They know about it.
And Malcolm X's widow, Betty Shabazz, lies in critical condition with burns over 80% of her body. We play an interview with her recorded 2 weeks ago on the anniversary of her husband's birth. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!
I'm Amy Goodman.
A socialist is France's new prime minister just one day after communists and socialists won parliamentary elections on vows to cut jobless rates. French President Jacques Chirac has appointed Lionel Jospin. Jospin takes over from conservative Alain Juppé, who formally resigned following his party's poor showing. Jospin's appointment gives him 2 weeks to form a coalition government. Nigerian warships pounded the port capital of Freetown today, taking the offensive against mutinous Sierra Leone troops, which overthrew the West African nation's civilian government. Mortar fire began at daybreak in Freetown's West End, where coup leaders are based. There was no immediate reports of casualties in the attack, which was the first real use of force by Nigerian troops in Sierra Leone since the May 25th coup. West African nations, led by Nigeria, have been trying to persuade coup leader Major Johnny Paul Koroma to hand back power to the elected president, now in exile in Guinea. Malcolm X's widow, Betty Shabazz, is in extremely critical condition today after being badly burned in a fire. Police said a boy who was relative of Betty Shabazz was arrested yesterday, hours after the early morning blaze in her apartment left her with third-degree burns over 80% of her body. They said he smelled of gasoline and was ringing doorbells in nearby Mount Vernon. The boy was taken into custody on charges of juvenile delinquency. According to police, longtime family lawyer, he said he was Mrs. Shabazz's grandson, Malcolm Shabazz. Percy Sutton, the friend, said the boy was the son of Mrs. Shabazz's daughter, Kabila. We'll have more on that story later in the show. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In a historic ruling late last week, a Los Angeles judge threw out the 25-year-old conviction of Black Panther Party leader Geronimo Pratt. Orange County Judge Everett Dickey ruled Thursday that the prosecution in the 1972 trial concealed that its star witness, Julius Butler, was a convicted felon who'd been recruited as a police and FBI informant and infiltrator. Judge Dickey ordered a new trial. Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti is expected to decide this week whether to appeal the ruling, hold a new trial, or release Pratt outright. Geronimo Pratt, now 49, was convicted of killing a Santa Monica teacher in a 1968 robbery and sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Pratt has always maintained his innocence and said that he was framed as part of the FBI's war against the Black Panther Party. Over the weekend, I spoke with one of Geronimo Pratt's attorneys, Julianne Drouse. I first asked her about her reaction to Judge Dickey's decision.
As we're standing by the fax machine waiting for it to come in, and as we were reading it page by page, I was absolutely delighted. I was ecstatic.
Can you tell us what the major objections of the judge were to the conviction of Geronimo Pratt?
Well, he only heard the one issue, and that issue was Julius Butler an informant, and was that information denied to the defense so that the jury could have all of the information it needed to come to a fair decision? And he found on every point for us. He found that he was, in fact, an informant. He found that not only was he an informant for the FBI, but more importantly, he was an informant for the Los Angeles Police Department and for the DA's office as well. And that the defense was denied all kinds of information about Butler, about what kind of favors he had received from the police department, from the LADA's office, and his motives for making up something on Geronimo Pratt. The jury was never allowed to hear that. And because of that, Geronimo Pratt did not get a fair trial. He was unjustly convicted.
What was Geronimo's reaction to the judge's decision?
Well, Stuart Hanlon was the one who talked to Geronimo, but from talking to Stuart, Geronimo was very happy. I don't know if he quite believes it yet. I mean, it's been 27 years. It's been a very, very long time for this to finally happen. And he's still not out yet. You know, after when he heard the decision, what really struck me is that we're sitting there, we're happy, and we had champagne in our office, and Geronimo went back to a prison cell, which, something should happen. The right thing will be for something to happen very soon, that he gets out of that prison cell, that he doesn't spend another day in that cell.
You're pushing for him to be released on bail. What is the possibility of that?
Well, not only are we asking for that he be released on bail, we're asking for an OR, release on own recognizance, while the DA makes a decision. But more than that, I think what needs to happen is that this case be dismissed, that the DA decide that there is no reason to do the right thing and to say, okay, you know, it's been 27 years, it's time just to stop and let this be over for Geronimo.
Can you tell us a little more about Julius Butler, what he was doing then and what he's doing today?
He was a hairstylist and friend of the police department, basically. He was helping them convict Geronimo Pratt in 1972, for which afterwards his record was expunged. He was allowed to go to law school. He has since become a lawyer, and I think now he is retired as a lawyer, but he was a lawyer working for an organization in Los Angeles up until recently.
Does Geronimo contend that he went into the Panthers to subvert them, working for the police at the time?
I would say that Geronimo is what Geronimo believes. I think there's evidence to support that.
Like?
Well, at this point, at this evidentiary hearing, we had testimony from police officers that at the time that he became a member of the Black Panther Party, he was in regular contact with members of the police department and informing them on a regular basis as to what the Panthers were planning, what they were going to do, how many people were going to be there, who was going to be there, and who was doing what. So while he was in the Panthers, he was, in fact, providing information to the police.
We're talking to Juliana Drouse, one of the co-counsel on the Geronimo Pratt case, and I'm sure you have heard by now that last Thursday, a judge has called for a second trial, although the Los Angeles District Attorney has the option to actually drop the case altogether. Juliana, your co-counsel, Stuart Hanlon, has said that he actually has some faith in Gil Garcetti. That was his office that revealed to them that Julius Butler was an informant.
That's right.
When did they reveal that?
What happened was that there's a investigator in their office by the name of Brian Hale, very good person. They actually have a few very good people in their office. And he was told to find whatever information was in that office, whatever information still existed regarding Julius Butler. In searching, it took him 2 minutes to find the cards that listed Julius Butler as an informant in that office. And interviewing people. Well, he wasn't the one who did the interview, but they then found out that Julius Butler had been provided money to purchase a gun from that office, provided money by somebody in that office to purchase a gun. That information was turned over to the the district attorneys who were prosecuting the petition. They turned that over to us when they got it. They did the right honorable thing then. This was last summer. We're thinking that they're going to do the right thing now.
Is the prosecutor still alive in the original case?
Well, yeah, he is. He's now a judge, Judge Kloustian. But, you know, there's actually no... at the evidentiary hearing, as to how much he knew about what his office was doing, there's still a question as to that.
Gil Garcetti now has to decide whether to seek a second trial or seek immediate dismissal of the case, just end it all, and Geronimo Pratt will go free. Of course, even if he does seek a new trial, he could set bail on, as you said, Geronimo could be released on his own recognizance until the trial. How could a second trial take place so many years, 25 years later?
I mean, realistically, it can't. But he has a third option. He has the option of appealing this decision, which I also don't think is going to happen because the judge did such a good job in writing his opinion. I don't think it's attackable. And reversing the reversal we got on habeas. As to whether it can go to, I can't imagine how they can put Julius Butler on the stand now with the information that is out now. He has no credibility.
Julianne Drouse, co-counsel in the case of Geronimo Pratt. And we'll update you on the situation, what happens to him, as we get news. You're listening to Democracy Now!, talking about court cases. The Supreme Court issues rulings at a rapid clip this time of year, just ahead of the court's summer recess. Among the most notable rulings recently was the case involving Paula Jones, the former Arkansas State employee who alleges she was sexually harassed by then-Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. The court ruled that Paula Jones' civil lawsuit against President Clinton can move forward, even though he is a sitting president. Less well-known was a Supreme Court decision last week to let the National Security Council maintain secret records against the efforts of civil libertarians to have them disclosed under the Freedom of Information Act. The court, without comment, turned away arguments by a journalist and a private research group that exempting the Security Council's documents guts the very concept of freedom of information. Like the National Security Council, however, the Supreme Court's proceedings have historically remained hidden and deliberately shrouded in mystery. But in recent years, one legal scholar has managed to push through the veil of secrecy and publish the tapes and transcripts of some landmark Supreme Court cases. His book is called May It Please the Court, and it's a compilation of the transcripts of tapes made since Earl Warren's Supreme Court that were made available to legal scholars, but to no one else. Peter Irons, a professor of political science and the director of the Earl Warren Bill of Rights Project at the University of California, San Diego, felt that wasn't the right thing to do, that the public should be able to hear these tapes, and he has made them available. We're going to start by asking Peter Irons to tell us how you got a hold of these tapes.
Getting a hold of the Supreme Court oral arguments tapes actually began about 15 years ago in a law school course in which one of the tapes was played, a course on appellate advocacy. It was a tape of an argument about withholding a passport from a well-known artist, Rockwell Kent, who was suspected of being a communist sympathizer. And listening to that argument, I was really struck by how much the court participates in argument. And it wasn't until years later when I was putting together a project to provide new teaching materials for courses on law in high school and college courses that I remembered the tapes and discovered that they were still in the National Archives. They'd been sitting there all these years. Hardly anybody knew they existed or made any use of them. So my idea was to take these tapes and edit them for classroom use. And originally, very ironically, I notified the court of my plans, and the administrative assistant to the Chief Justice wrote and said he thought it was a great idea, and I'd sent him a early copy of one of the edited tapes, and he said he'd listened to it and thought it was extremely educational. And then it was very surprising when the project was completed and just about to be released when the court changed its mind and issued a statement that they were planning a lawsuit against me for releasing the tapes in violation of an agreement that everybody who uses tapes had to sign, saying that they would be used only for private research and teaching. I thought that was flatly unconstitutional, and I told the court so. But anyway, they made this public statement, which created a tremendous wave of publicity.
And you ended up with them.
Pardon me?
You ended up being able to use them.
Well, I ended up being able to use the tapes only because the court, after about 4 months, changed its mind again and backed down and issued another statement that they were releasing the tapes without any restrictions for any person. Previously, in fact, the court had written a letter to the National Archives saying that I was the only person who was not allowed any further access to the tapes. That, in my opinion, was even more unconstitutional. And I think somebody on the court finally read the First Amendment and realized that they were way out on a limb and had no right to withhold public records.
Setting the Supreme Court straight on the laws they're supposed to be enforcing.
Well, it's ironic because, in fact, the court itself, there are very few restraints on what the court can do. The court is, in fact, the final court of appeal for the entire country. And I think when this thing came up in 1993, someone told me that Jay Leno had made a quip on his show that if the Supreme Court loses this case, who would they appeal to? And it's sort of, you know, there's a serious side to that question. The court has the power to reprimand or punish any of the attorneys who appear before it, and I'm a member of the Supreme Court bar, so I certainly didn't want to risk my professional status. But at the same time, I thought the public really had a right to and a desire to hear these arguments. And after 4 years, I think all of the, you know, all of the controversy is blown away, and everybody now realizes that these are a significant resource, which is why we put out subsequent series.
You dedicated, May It Please the Court, to Justice William Brennan and Justice Thurgood Marshall. Why have you chosen these two?
Well, in my opinion, both Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall, who served together on the court for a long time, were, in fact, the strongest defenders of the Bill of Rights. These are cases that deal with the Bill of Rights, all of the parts dealing with freedom of religion and speech and press and the right of criminal defendants and the civil rights laws that were enacted under the 14th Amendment. And there are no justices in recent times who have been more devoted to those principles, that the people are more important than the government when there's a conflict between individual rights and state power. And I'd always admired them for very different reasons. And in fact, they're very different kinds of people. Justice Brennan was a real intellectual bulwark of the court, really the right hand of Chief Justice Warren for many years. And Justice Marshall, of course, the first and, in my opinion, only African-American on the court, or at least who understands the plight of African-Americans, represented a tradition of fighting for rights throughout his career, even before he joined the court.
Let's talk about some of those cases Justice Thurgood Marshall was involved in that you document in May It Please the Court.
Well, I think the most important and certainly the most dramatic in the entire series is the argument Justice Marshall made as an attorney for the NAACP in the Little Rock school integration case.
In fact, we're coming up on its 30th anniversary.
And that's almost here. That's right. And in fact, this was the case really that focused national attention on the resistance to the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision. Southerners had adopted a policy of massive resistance. Almost every Southern member of Congress had signed a petition denouncing the Supreme Court for being lawless. And state officials around the country and in the South particularly were urging defiance of the law. And this is a case that really epitomized this conflict. No official is above the law. This applies to the President of the United States all the way down to a county sheriff. And the governor of Arkansas, in refusing to admit black students to Central High School in Little Rock, and also calling out troops to keep them out, was defying the Supreme Court, defying the federal government, and the President of the United States.
Well, we're going to hear Thurgood Marshall's oral arguments before the Supreme Court when he was still a lawyer when we come back. We're talking to Peter Irons, Professor of Political Science and the Director of the Earl Warren Bill of Rights Project at the University of California, San Diego. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to our look at some of the Supreme Court's historic cases over the last 40 years, we now talk about the Little Rock, Arkansas desegregation case of 1957. And here's some of the oral arguments of then NAACP attorney Thurgood Marshall.
Education is not the teaching of three R's. The education is teaching of the overall citizenship, to learn to live together with fellow citizens, and above all, to learn to obey the law. And the damage to the education in Arkansas and in Little Rock and in Central High comes about through the order of Judge Lemley, which says that not only the school board and the state can and should submit to mob violence and threats of mob violence, but that the federal judiciary likewise should do so. I don't know of any more horrible destruction of principle of citizenship than to tell young children that those of you who withdrew, rather than to go to school with Negroes, those of you who were punished last year, the few that the school board did punish, come back, all is forgiven, you win. And therefore, I'm not worried about the Negro children at this stage. I don't believe they're in this case as such. I worry about the white children in Little Rock who are told, as young people, that the way to get your rights is to violate the law and defy the lawful authorities. I'm worried about their future. I don't worry about those Negro kids' future. They've been struggling with democracy long enough. They know about it.
So his argument was tremendously dramatic and very powerful. He used all of his oratorical skills. And, of course, I think he realized that the court was sympathetic. He was not really trying to convince them. He was trying to make a statement to the court and to the country.
Is there any other cases that he argues before the Supreme Court that you include in May It Please the Court?
That's his only oral argument. He, of course, argued many cases, many of them before Brown. It's unfortunate that the tapes don't go back to Brown versus Board of Education. It's my strong feeling that Chief Justice Warren decided to tape all the arguments after Brown when he realized that there were very significant cases and issues for which there should be some historical record, particularly these tape recordings. But in Marshall's arguments before the court in a number of cases, he was really laying the groundwork very carefully for the final, most important case of Brown, and then the Little Rock case, of course, testing whether Brown would be implemented. But Justice Marshall was also, after he joined the court, a very, very effective and very frequent questioner of attorneys, sort of being on the other side of the bars, so to speak. And he could give attorneys a very hard time if he thought they were evading the issue or failing to deal with an issue. Roe versus Wade is one of them. When he asked the state's lawyers very directly if they had any evidence, any medical evidence, that a fetus was considered a person before birth.
We say there is life from the moment of impregnation.
That's the Texas lawyer, Jay Floyd. He's questioned by Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall.
And do you have any scientific data to support that?
Well, we begin, Mr. Justice, in our brief, with the development of the human embryo, carrying it through to the development of the fetus from about 7 to 9 days after conception.
Well, what about 6 days?
We don't know.
But the statute goes all the way back to 1 hour.
I don't, Mr. Justice, there are unanswerable questions in this field.
I appreciate it.
This is an artless statement on my part.
I withdraw the question.
And they had to admit they had no such evidence. And that, in fact, became the central point in the court's decision, that no court had ever held that a fetus was a person within the meaning of the Constitution. It's a debatable issue, but certainly one in which Marshall pointed out through his questions that the state did not have any real precedent to stand on.
Let's talk about some of the First Amendment cases that you include in this book. For example, the New York Times versus the United States.
Well, the New York Times case is most people know it as the Pentagon Papers case. And this, of course, is another real challenge between branches of government and the press, the federal government trying to prevent the Times from publishing excerpts from a secret history of the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg had provided to the Times, and for which he was later charged in a criminal case that eventually was dismissed. But this is an argument really where the Solicitor General of the United States, Irwin Griswold, who was a former Harvard Law School dean, very prominent lawyer, was arguing a case that he was not able to provide any details about. It's sort of ironic because Griswold had provided the court with a sealed brief, including excerpts from parts of the Pentagon Papers that had not yet been published that the government was claiming would irreparably damage national security.
The heart of our case is that the publication of the material specified in my closed brief will, as I have tried to argue materially affect the security of the United States. It will affect lives. It will affect the process of the termination of the war. It will affect the process of recovering prisoners of war. I cannot say that the termination of the war or recovering prisoners of war is something which has an immediate effect on the security of the United States. I say that it has such an effect on the security of the United States that it ought to be the basis of an injunction.
Griswold hadn't even read that brief, and therefore he wasn't able to answer any questions about it. And years later, he admitted that he was wrong in that case, that, in fact, nothing in that record would have damaged national security, and he felt that he had been misled by the Justice Department.
Why wouldn't he have suspicions at the time?
Well, that's a good question. I think as a very patriotic man and as a high-ranking government official, he trusted the officials in the Justice Department and in the Pentagon. And when he discovered later, I don't know why he didn't demand to see the brief or read the sealed record before it was delivered to the court. But I think he wanted to do so, my guess is, to avoid inadvertently revealing anything during argument. If he was pressed on an issue, it was better for him to say, Your Honor, I simply don't know, rather than to blurt out something that might be damaging.
We're talking to Peter Irons, who is the force behind May It Please the Court, 23 transcripts of 23 live recordings of landmark cases as argued before the Supreme Court. He got a hold of the tapes, and he decided that the American public had a right to hear them. And these are the tapes that we're talking about today. William Kunstler died more than a year ago now, and it's hard to believe, but he has argued a few of the cases that you document in your book.
Well, Kunstler was a very prolific Supreme Court advocate, very different from most. He certainly was not one of these button-down lawyers who approaches argument trying to find what the court wants to hear. Kunstler said exactly what he felt in these cases. He was very blunt. He was earthy. He was colloquial. He talked about Barbara Bush's clothes and cocktail weenies, and in defending the person who burned an American flag at the Republican convention in 1984, he really made an argument that was calculated, I think, to offend some members of the court. And he did so, I think, to point out that they had very, very difficult time dealing with the issue of how far the state can regulate conduct that is really expressing an idea, however that idea is expressed.
And desecrate means to divest of a sacred character or office, to divert from a sacred purpose, to violate the sanctity of, to profane, the opposite of consecrate. It's used all over for commercial purposes. I noticed that Barbara Bush wore a flag scarf, for example. There are flag bikinis, there are flag everything. There are little cocktail flags that you put into a hot dog or a meatball and then throw in the garbage pail. They're flags under the Texas statute. They don't be made out of cloth. But I think there are all sorts of flags used commercially. I'm not sure in my heart whether I think there's any control over the use of the flag. Not on the criminal side, anyway. And I wanted to essentially close with two remarks. One, Justice Jackson said in Barnett, those who begin coercive elimination of dissent soon find themselves eliminating dissenters. And I understand that this flag has serious, important meanings. Chief has mentioned many times that it's not just pieces of material, blue and white and red, that it has real meaning to real people out there. But that does not mean that it may have different meanings to other people out there, and that they may not, under the First Amendment, show their feelings by what Texas calls desecration of a venerated object. I think it's a most important case. I sense that it goes to the heart of the First Amendment. To hear things or to see things that we hate tests the First Amendment more than seeing or hearing things that we like. It wasn't designed for things we like. They never needed a First Amendment. This statute or this amendment was designed so that the things we hate can have a place in the marketplace of ideas and can have an area where protest can find itself. I submit that this court should, on whatever ground it feels right, should affirm the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals with reference to this statute and this conviction. Thank you very much.
And Kunstler had argued other cases, particularly a case involving segregation of swimming pools in Jackson, Mississippi. So he really took on the hardest cases. And I think that that's part of his legacy, is that unlike many lawyers, he never backed down from a difficult or controversial case.
Explain that case in Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, that was a case that's not very famous. Very few people outside constitutional law professors know of it. And it's a case that stemmed from an order of a federal judge who was appointed by John F. Kennedy. And one of the unfortunate parts of President Kennedy's legacy is that he appointed some vicious racists to the federal courts, feeling that he had to placate Senator Eastland of Mississippi, who chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee for many, many years. And in the process, these judges were often and almost usually overruled by higher courts and the Supreme Court. But in this case, the city of Jackson responded to a desegregation order by leasing all of its public swimming pools, I think there were five at the time, to the YMCA for $1 a year, and they were reopened on a segregated basis. And the plaintiffs in this case argued that this was unconstitutional state action, that the city had done this knowing that they would be resegregated, and we're depriving people of a public service.
I think the general definition that we would like to urge upon this court is that an incident of slavery is anything that makes a black man reasonably feel inferior to a white man. It's the opposite of what Mr. Justice Brown said in Plessy. He said if the black race chooses to put that interpretation upon riding and segregated coaches, that's their lookout, not ours. But I submit that it is your lookout, our lookout, because this court is really nothing more than an extension of the American personality, an extension of the American sociology. And that is the heart of this case. That is why I think the court must take a stand and say, yes, the closing of the pools violates the 13th Amendment, that we as a court have just as much responsibility as Congress, just as much responsibility as the executive in wiping out these badges, because unless they are wiped out, no black person can feel secure in the United States, and every black person will begin eventually to build up a rage that is already sufficient enough, that will build up a rage inside that he knows that in white eyes, he is an inferior person.
And in fact, the court ruled in favor of the city in this case. Another irony is that Justice Hugo Black, who almost always defended the First Amendment, was not so strong on civil rights cases. And in this case, Black said that operating swimming pools was not an essential public function like fire protection or police or schools. And therefore, the city, if it wanted to get rid of the pools, could do so. And how it did so was not the court's business.
Two other cases included in your equal protection of the laws are Heart of Atlanta Motel versus the United States and Loving versus Virginia.
Well, these are cases that really raise some very significant issues. Heart of Atlanta was a case testing the federal government's power to enforce the 14th Amendment, the ban on racial discrimination in all public accommodations. And in fact, it's interesting that the court based that decision not on the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, but on the Commerce Clause. It seems a little surprising, but the court ruled that interstate travel, particularly for African Americans, was impeded by racial segregation. They had to drive farther to find lodging and food, and it disrupted the flow of commerce. The court really, I think, broke new legal ground, but it upheld the nation's commitment to equal opportunity. Loving versus Virginia is a fascinating case because it has echoes today, or it has given echoes today, of the gay rights, the gay marriage case in Hawaii. Loving was a case involving an interracial couple, a black woman and a white man, who lived in rural Virginia and who were dragged out of bed in the middle of the night by the sheriff after they got married, and in a sense exiled from the state of Virginia. They agreed to avoid prosecution to leave the state. They finally returned. They had been encouraged by Bobby Kennedy, who was then attorney general, who helped them find a lawyer, to challenge this law, and the court ruled unanimously that preventing any person from marrying another person on the basis of race violated the Constitution. So whether that will be extended to sexual orientation by the state court in Hawaii is a very interesting question. But Loving really made an important precedent for that proposition, that the state cannot determine who anyone can marry.
Who argued for the Lovings?
A lawyer named Philip Hirschkopf, who's in Alexandria, Virginia, is still practicing law there, very active civil rights lawyer. He argued the case very persuasively.
Mr. Hirschkopf.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice, may it please the court. You have before you today what we consider the most odious of the segregation laws and the slavery laws. And our view of this law, and we hope to clearly show, is that this is slavery law. And the issue is, may a state proscribe a marriage between two adult consenting individuals because of their race? These people, were they to go back to Virginia, and they are in Virginia now, will be subject to immediate arrest under the fornication statute and the lewd and lascivious cohabitation statute. And more than that, there are many, many other problems with these. Their children would be declared bastards under many Virginia decisions. All the registration statutes were enacted in the 1924 period. And these are the statutes, basically, which you have to have a certificate of racial composition in the state of Virginia. The statutes which we find absolutely most odious, the statutes reflect back to Nazi Germany and to the present South African situation. The present bill, as it sits on the books, is that law from 1924. And it was entitled A Bill to Preserve the Integrity of the White Race when it was initially issued. They were not concerned with racial integrity, but racial supremacy of the white race.
You've been listening to historic tape recordings of oral arguments made before the Supreme Court over the last, well, more than 40 years. Peter Irons has been our guest, a professor of political science and the director of the Earl Warren Bill of Rights Project at the University of California, San Diego. His book is called May It Please the Court. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Betty Shabazz, the wife of slain African-American revolutionary Malcolm X, lies in critical condition at a New York hospital today. She suffered third-degree burns over 80% of her body after a fire broke out early Sunday morning at her apartment in Yonkers, New York. Police have arrested her 12-year-old grandson, Malcolm Shabazz, in connection with the blaze. Doctors say the 63-year-old Dr. Betty Shabazz, who's been the head of the Office of Institutional Advancement at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, New York, remains in extremely critical condition. Just 2 weeks ago, on the 72nd anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X, I interviewed Betty Shabazz about her life with her husband with WBAI Pacifica radio producer Bernard Wife. We talked to her just after playing a speech by Malcolm X on the Congo. It was perhaps her last broadcast interview before this injury.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Is this Mr. Bernard Wife?
Yes, it is.
Okay, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm here with Amy Goodman.
Good morning, Dr. Shabazz.
How are you, Ms. Goodman?
Good.
Okay.
It's always hard to break into a speech of Malcolm X. Listeners before were saying, why did we cut it off and we had to do it again? But that's just a testament to the power of Malcolm X as a speaker.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things is that a lot of things are just in print as we speak about Mobutu.
Mm-hmm.
And there, and yet, we hear him talking about him 32 years ago.
Yeah, we're going to hear
I mean, is that profound or what?
Quite.
Okay, all right. Hey, he should have been a foreign policy advisor.
Under different circumstances, I'm sure he would have been.
Okay, okay. He was a great guy. He was a great guy. And one of the consolations that I have is that people have grown to such an extent that their conceptual framework has been broadened, and they now understand where he was coming from. At least some of the thinkers understand where he was coming from, and I am very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your reflections on this day?
My reflections every day. Every day I'm reminded of this guy, okay? You know, I was reared in Detroit, Michigan, and with not a very ethnic kind of upbringing, but yet it was. And so that my whole reflection on the historic condition of our people all over the world certainly comes from Malcolm. And I think that when you are talking about living in a society where, you know, everyone is enjoying the fruits of their labor and enjoying freedoms and being able to work and live where you want to live and go to school and have all those opportunities and options, you know, never really entered my mind. My parents reared me to be happy and reared me with the thought of going to school and for myself, and so that the extent of my globalness certainly came from Malcolm.
We were just listening to the speech right after your house in Queens was firebombed. We believe it was the next day, where he was talking about, actually just about now, going into the part about the Congo. Could you set the stage for this time?
Well, number one, you know, there was such confusion about his philosophy. Some were saying he was too religious, and I think that's even in the speech where he says, you know, for the political, I'm too religious, and for the religious, I'm too political, and for something, I'm too worldly. You know, he was like walking on a tightrope. But there were several things that was happening at that time, and one very important one was that there was fear that the leader, Elijah Muhammad, would not be able to carry on much longer, and the one at the forefront was Malcolm, and he would take over. That was as far as from his mind as we are from any distal part. His main agenda was helping black people, and he didn't care if it was Elijah that was at the head of it or his son Wallace. He just wanted to help. One of the things is, you know, that when Malcolm came out of prison and joined that movement, they only had four mosques and cities populated by very senior members. And before his expulsion from the movement, they had a mosque in every major metropolitan city. And a lot of people don't really look at that or focus on that. They always look at Malcolm and say that he was aggressive and he wanted to take over. He didn't want to take over. He wanted to help. And, of course, after he got married and had children, his role strengthened in terms of what he wanted to do to help change the world.
Mm-hmm. On February 20th of 1965, in a telephone conversation with Alex Haley, Malcolm said that the more I keep thinking about this thing, the things that have been happening lately, I'm not at all sure it's the Muslims.
Well, let me just tell you, Alex kind of took, what do you call that,
creative license?
Yes, absolutely. And he did that after Malcolm's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm said from the beginning that it would be the black Muslims in coordination with the government. He never changed. That was Haley's part that he put in there. One of the things he was saying that he only trusted one woman, and that was me. Alex Chape put it to four. I don't know who the other three were supposed to be. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But, no, he was a thinker. Why would he at the last minute say that he wasn't sure that the black Muslims were the only one involved? He knew from the very beginning who it was. He had been told who it was.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any indication that the government was also involved?
Let me just say that I always repeat what my husband said. He said that the government, along with the black Muslim movement.
And we're talking to Dr. Betty Shabazz on the 72nd anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X.
Dr. Shabazz, do you think that in your lifetime you will ever find out exactly what happened?
Of course.
How do you think that will, that information will
Well,
come
I
out?
Certainly don't want to discuss that at this point, but of course.
Well, what I've found is, and I generally ask whenever there was a, I got in contact with someone involved in the liberation struggle in Africa, everyone that I spoke to always knew who Malcolm X was.
Well, they, you know, they read about him. If you look at Malcolm's autobiography, he even talks about that Nelson Mandela had been jailed, and a lot of people at that particular time didn't even know who the world Mandela was. Do you know, in this country?
Mm-hmm.
I am astounded at his knowledge base of our people all over the world, you know. And even just like now, some 32 years later, we are learning about Mobutu. And it was in his book 32 years ago when he talks about Mozambique and Angola, you know. About 5 years ago, people saying, what, where is it? You know, he talked about it. So, I mean, he number one, he was very bright, but it is unfortunate that what happened. I think that had he lived, this world certainly would be a far different place. You know, his agenda certainly was on time.
Did you witness him absorbing that information? Did he read a lot around the house?
You know, he was an avid reader, and he developed that while he was in prison. Now, Spike Lee says that that Elijah Muhammad's followers in prison taught him to go to the dictionary. That was untrue. There was a black American who was a professor who was in prison. And Malcolm respected his ability to talk about almost anything and everything in a very clear way. He enjoyed his use of the language. And based on his admiration for this guy and his knowledge base, he went to the dictionary and started studying. When I married him, he could read any difficult book in 3 or 4 hours. You know, it would take me a couple of weeks to read it. Well, I had to keep stopping to take care of the children and the whole nine yards. But I basically read about 2 books a month, but he could read in 4 hours. He could finish any difficult book. So, yes, he did. One of the things when he was in Massachusetts, some white guy died and left his library to that prison and a lot of the classics. And so that Malcolm read 7/8 of those books, so that he was, of course, an avid reader. And I think it's remarkable. He certainly was brighter than I am and a lot of other people.
You know, we've seen a lot of documentation and documents declassified in terms of the John Kennedy assassination, in terms of the Martin Luther King assassination. Of course, not all, but a lot. How about in terms of your husband's assassination?
What about it?
How much has been released in terms of, you know, the CIA and all government documents around?
Well, a number of people have gotten that information. Of course, you know, all of the names and some other information have been blocked out, but I have not requested it, don't want it, don't feel that the majority of it is true. One of the things we know that informers, if they couldn't find anything, they would make up things. when Malcolm was in Africa the first time, his first trip, when he would go down to breakfast in every area that he would go to, every country that he would go to, there was this guy who was always there. And my husband sometime had a humorous streak about him. He was late one morning going down to get his coffee, and the guy was sitting there real pensive, you know, wondering, did he leave? And my husband went by his table and said, I fooled you this morning, didn't I? You know, and the guy laughed. But there were people who said that we have been paid to, we are paid to observe you, to watch you, to see what you do, that I wished I could do the things that you're doing, and would praise him for what he was doing and that he was doing no harm.
Mm-hmm. Following the assassination, life...
I wonder, though, why would somebody pay money? Of course, they paid money to ladies to try to entrap him, and I mean, he would share it with me. It was just... You know, we could do better with taxpayers' money.
Oh, for sure. Following the assassination, though, life for you was no crystal steer. It was kind of rough there for a while.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, six children. I had four. 6 months later, you know, God saw to it that I had two more. And, you know, I wonder what was all of that about. You know, I couldn't handle one. And then I had two, and I can remember Juanita Portier. Had gotten her baby crib for me, which was a real large baby crib, and had put the buntings on it and the this and that and little toy at the top, you know, little carousel-type toy at the top. And then I had two babies, and we were wondering, what are we going to do? We got to get another bed, you know, we got to go through... decorating this bed all over again. And I said to Juanita Portier, listen here. I shared the story of the Dr. Barnett and what her husband had said. And I said, buy an extra bunting, some more blankets, and put the bunting at the foot of the bed. And, you know, this it was a huge baby bed, so that they looked lost in this big bed. So they stayed there until, I guess, they were about 4 months. So, you know, God is good. It was rough, but I made it. I made it because I had very good friends. I didn't have a lot, but I had some friends I had were good, and they span the ethnic and economic and social levels, and they are still friends today, and I am very grateful. Uh-huh. Very grateful.
Oh, good. Well, we're grateful that they were there for you and that you're still here for us.
Well, you know, got to walk in his footsteps. You know, basically, when you look at what he was about, international sisterhood, brotherhood, still valid, human rights for our people.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dr. Betty Shabazz, the wife of slain civil rights leader Malcolm X. It was recorded just 2 weeks ago with Pacifica WBAI producer Bernard White. Again, 63-year-old Betty Shabazz lies in critical condition in a New York hospital, suffering from severe burns over 80% of her body. Her 12-year-old grandson, Malcolm Shabazz, who'd been living with her, has been arrested in connection with the blaze at her Yonkers, New York apartment. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York engineered our show from the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C. Errol Maitland is our assistant producer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!. Tomorrow, a special on the anniversary of the birth of Allen Ginsberg. Thanks for listening.
WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington.